Okay, we're back.
We are back on a snowy March.
Frickin' March
day. This is going to be the
all
best.
All the snow melted and
now it's coming back. This is going to be the best Christmas.
What do
ever.
You want for Christmas?
I don't know. Like that. In my younger days. But I like thinking about and hearing people talk about books, taking books seriously. And people take books that are written seriously all the time, but they don't take books that are in genres very seriously. People do it more these days.
And we're wearing our pajamas.
And we are.
While we're...
I'm not.
We should also mention the book that we're doing.
Yeah, the book
today.
We're doing. Anyway.
But we should say
we have the two mics.
We are the Forbidden Books Group presents Necronomipod!
The lair of the bookish worm.
And
this is our third installment.
Our third installment. And what we do here is we, every episode, we pick a book, a horror book of some, an old one, a new one.
Newish.
We've done a brand new one. World War Z was less than a year old when we did
that. That's true.
Yeah. We sort of take it seriously and sort of have a little impromptu book group.
So.
Whenever I've been in book groups before, I usually sit back and listen.
That's please. Sweet. And we usually have a cocktail, so our cocktail for this evening is
we're going to call it the Lady of Darkness. And this was one that we just made up, and by we, I mean me. It is...
I was going to bring Rice Aroni, because it's a San Francisco treat.
The Lady of Darkness is Kirschwasser, one part Kirschwasser, one part Kahlua, and a splash of cream. Serve over ice.
Was it shaken? Would you shake this?
I would stir it. Maybe throw in a cherry and a filbert.
This book takes place in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, yeah.
And that's why I was going to bring glasses full of Rice Aroni.
Glasses full of Rice Aroni, exactly.
And what's the beer in San Francisco?
Is that Ankerstein Town?
Ankerstein.
Yeah. Oh, I had some Ankerstein in San Francisco.
That would have been a good. That would be a good drink if you cannot make the.
The Dark Lady.
The Dark Lady.
The Lady of Darkness. Lady of Darkness. I like that. I think that's Lady of Darkness is a good drink. I recommend it to anybody.
It's delicious. And we're drinking it now.
Indeed. So so let's talk about this book.
Oh, I'm so avoiding talking.
So, okay. Now, this isn't really fair. The other mic here finished this book a good 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
Yeah, and I finished it on the bus this morning.
Yeah. So I'll be relying on you.
Okay. So let's talk about San Francisco. So this novel is very situated
it's
in San Francisco.
It's very San Francisco centric.
Yeah, San Francisco centric.
Fritz Leiber lived out his last drunken days in San Francisco.
Yeah, apparently, I was going to spend some time looking up a biography here. But yes, after Fritz Leiber's first wife died, he went on a several year bender, which is. Captured in this novel. I think this book has a very autobiographical.
Very much so.
In fact, the main character's name is Franz, which is not Fritz. Franz. And what's his name? Weston. Franz Weston.
Franz Weston.
Yeah. And he is a horror writer.
And I am looking at the Fritz Leiber pages.
Leiber.
Oops.
Oops.
He I've been was calling him ordained in the Episcopal Church.
Really?
Yes. And then he joined his father's Shakespeare company.
That's right. You know, Shakespeare comes up in this. I don't know if you caught that. There's a Shakespearean element.
Well, I feel like it's very Tempest.
It's very Tempest. It is
Bravo!
Very
Tempest.
Bravo! Bravo! We both caught it independently of each other. We are so SMRT. Yes. Now, this is, as far as I can tell, this is Fritz Leiber's last novel. It's kind of his swan song. Just like The Tempest is more or less Shakespeare's final play.
Yeah, you're right. I'm looking at these pages, and it says Our Lady of Darkness was in 1977, and then he wrote another tale called The Button Molder in 1979.
And was that a novel?
It is a tale.
A tale, yeah.
I don't know if it's a book.
Later in his career, he did some autobiographical stuff too. He was winding down quite a bit at that point. Having achieved grandmaster status. there's a scene. I didn't catch it at all until there's a scene late in the book where he lays down a yardstick or a ruler as though it was a magic wand, it says. I'm like, oh, it's Prospero breaking his staff. And then I'm like, oh, and then went back and I reread, and quickly reviewing. It's like, oh, he's doing a little bit of a Tempest thing here. Because he knew he's Shakespeare. Oh, very much so.
He did.
Those of you who listened to us blathering on about Conjure Wife, we got a little Macbeth on in that. So this is Fritz Leiber's Tempest, which I think is very cool. I mean, I'm not sure how well it maps onto it.
I think it's a nod to it.
This whole novel.
It's a pastiche.
Yeah, this whole novel is a nod to stuff.
It is basically, it's like that little bird dipping into the glass. There's lots of nodding. It's like a bobblehead. Yeah.
Now, how much do you know, Mike, about all the stuff about Lovecraft and Clark Ashton Smith?
I did not grow up in a Lovecraftian world. Either.
This is all adult folly for me. But
but I wasn't much of a love. I've never been much of a Lovecraft reader. In fact, I find even the movies that were based on his books, I've never really enjoyed that much, quite frankly.
Well, so. I've still been trying to get my hands on From Beyond, which is my favorite one.
And I did try reading the book that you lent me, Chaula,
Cthulhu.
Cthulhu.
Yeah. Did I lend you Cthulhu? Which one?
You lent me a. There's a bunch of stories based on the myth of, and I did enjoy the preface quite a bit.
Oh, I remember. Yeah. Well, anyhow, we're veering wildly off the subject.
But I don't think you can talk about him without talking about Lovecraft.
No, you can. I mean, Lovecraft
they sort of shake hands with each other.
Yeah, because Fritz Leiber was a Lovecraft convert. At a very young age, Fritz Leiber read the pulp magazines that Lovecraft contributed to, specifically Weird Tales. And he talks about in this book that stack of old pulp magazines that gets torn apart. At first, the covers are gone. We should actually, when we put this up, we should provide a link to a database of old Weird Tales covers because they are definitely.
Oh yeah,
they're definitely.
Actually, I've gone to that website already.
Those are the greatest covers. So fantastically lurid. And in fact, in the climactic scene of the book, those magazines, the Weird Tales and Unknown Worlds, and all these magazines that now if you could pick a copy of. Find an original copy of them. They're almost unopenable. The pulp, the acid in the paper is so destructive to the paper itself that it's, they're literally falling apart. They're almost unreadable.
Which is basically what happens at the end of the book.
Yeah, they all fall apart. This book is really a nod. Not a nod, it's a homage. It's kind of like a big involved love letter to the whole Weird Tale tradition, and I think you noticed, Mike, that not a lot goes on.
I brought this up.
Is this the crux of the biscuit?
Yes, I brought this up in Conjure Wife, which did not happen as much in Conjure Wife.
No,
but there is a foreshadowing in Conjure Wife. Of the horrible things to come in Our Lady Darkness, because it is page upon page of mini lecture series.
Which
I found grueling to know.
Yeah, well, as a person who doesn't really get into Lovecraft, this is actually pretty fast moving.
It's lots of telling and not a lot of showing.
Yeah. There's Lovecraft's stories are very they're very thin on action.
And while there is some discovery in this, not like, you know, the protagonist makes discoveries, mm-hmm. it's really in a lot of telling.
Yeah.
You don't see him making discoveries.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talking about.
Yeah. Well, you read you must have read the story then in the Cthulhu book I gave you, The Call of Cthulhu, the first one.
I didn't read any of the stories. I just read the preface.
Oh.
Or the introduction, which I found very fascinating.
Because the way that Lovecraft sort of plotted his stories, it's investigation. It's like reading about a person researching a term paper. That it's about that exciting. But what this research discovers is, you know, the ultimate truths behind the veil of everyday life, and some people find that very appealing. You know, some people call it cosmic horror. That behind our regular daylight, our regular daily life, that we're just, you know, skating on the surface of enormous forces they're not even good, they're not evil, they're just indifferent. You know, the only thing that keeps us alive is the fact that we're not even worth noticing.
Well, partly I'm wondering was he Jewish?
Fritz Leiber?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Because it reminds me a lot of the idea of, you know, in scholarship, especially like in the Kabbalah mm-hmm. And the Midrash of Scripture, that all the meanings behind mm-hmm. behind the script,
yeah,
you know, in a way, and that you do, and that your connection to the divine is through scholarship.
Yes,
is through scholarship.
It's a Lovecraftian thing to do, is to take that idea that the connection with the divine. Or the ultimate, or the worlds beyond our world, through books, through writings, and Lovecraft invented the Necronomicon, which is this forbidden book.
Which is what?
In fact, all the forbidden books. I mean, that's where we get part of our podcast's title from, is forbidden books. These books that are so powerful because they connect you with this unseen world.
Right. And not just what's said, but the actual book itself,
the actual word on the page
mm-hmm. is a, you know, and I don't know a lot about this, but what I've read about in that kind of scholarship, especially in the Kabbalah or in the Midrash and stuff, is that it's almost a negative space of the words mm-hmm. holds a meaning. So even where the words aren't. Yeah.
Interesting.
So, and that's why the letters and yeah. the words, and, yeah. you know, and that goes back to abracadabra and all that stuff.
Yeah,
all
yeah. those, it's the Bible code. No, I mean that runs all through Lovecraft, and it's one of the tropes that Lovecraft's followers, and there's thousands of writers out there. Most of them failed. Well, Lovecraft was a failed writer. I mean, he died penniless.
Well, you can see where a really bad writer would use that technique of just telling you everything.
Yeah.
You know, you might as well just hand you a term. You're right. Yeah. Like you said, a term paper.
Yeah, exactly. There's one specific Lovecraft story that I think Fritz Leiber has in mind here, and he actually names it. He calls it out in the book. It's called The Haunter of the Dark. And it's been a while since I've read this story, although I did just read a very good comic book based on it. The Haunter of the Dark is about this, I believe it's a student who's renting a room. And he sees out of his window the steeple of some building, and it turns out that this building is was the place that some cult had unspeakable practices. Listeners, if there are any of you out there,
like sex and murder, and
yeah, well, no, jobs and... no, I think it was a cult that worshipped one of the outer gods, one of these. I think specifically it was Nyarlathotep, which is a Lovecraft invented god. There is this presence that this guy connects with when he sees this steeple. And the climax of the story, if I remember correctly, is that it comes straight at him across space through his window. This idea that the Fritz Leiber picks up on here, of sitting in his apartment looking at Corona Heights in San Francisco. And then in his way, he has the TV tower, right, and the Transamerica building, this modern pyramid. Lovecraft was way into pyramids. He wrote about them and ancient architecture as like places of power. Right. And so Fritz Leiber is just sort of updating it and translating it from Egypt or Providence, Rhode Island, which is what where Haunter in the Dark takes place, to San Francisco, which is great because it enables him to do lots of other fun things, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
I didn't know that was already sort of presupposed in Lovecraft.
It's one of his great stories. In fact, the character in there is the main character is a guy named Robert Blake, who is not
the guy from Beretta.
Not the guy from Beretta.
The murderer.
No. It's Robert Blake. It's a slightly changed version of one of Lovecraft's young fans and correspondents, Robert Bloch, who wrote Psycho.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, young Robert Bloch.
You know, you brought up that scene, and I have to say, that scene where he was...
when he's on Corona Heights.
When he's looking out his... he's at Corona Heights looking back at his apartment.
Yeah, and he sees his apartment.
And he sees that face.
Yeah, he sees the brown figure.
Well, to me, out of the whole book, that was the scariest.
That was that actually that,
that
it
was
didn't,
so
it
well,
didn't make me jump, but it gave me a little
it gave me a song. Shiver. And like, it actually shiver. Like
yeah, that was very effective.
It was very effective.
Yeah, it was really good. And that was that's
and
a
even
pure
right
love
now,
that moment.
And right now, I even have the visual in my mind, and it's creeping me out.
Yeah, yeah.
And it almost, to me, the face is almost like the face of that Scream face, except brown.
Yeah, with the noseless triangle, the skull face.
Right.
The it's interesting
almost
that
beaky, almost
that,
bird-like.
That moment where the entity, the supernatural entity, sort of breaks the laws of physics, and it's really frightening, and it reminds me of Japanese horror films. Specifically,
yeah, very much so.
Specifically of The Ring, when you're watching this video, and suddenly the monster crawls right out of the video. So in this book, he's looking through his binoculars,
it's
and
like
suddenly
right in the binoculars,
and it comes right through the binoculars at him. That is really
that freaked me.
I mean, I was starting to get a little bit too.
Yeah, and that's the only part of the book that did.
Well, the
except there is a couple of times where that face, there's something about that face,
something about
the description of that face. And
yeah,
there must be something very archetypal about that kind of face. Yeah.
The description of that particular the description of that particular entity is a very weird tales kind of thing, and I can show you we can put links to on the web, if maybe. Well, actually, no. You'll see these if you go to the Weird Tales covers or covers of Clark Ashton Smith books. That is a very Clark Ashton Smith kind of ghost entity or a sorcerer.
Well,
entity.
And in my mind, it almost in my mind's eye, it's almost like a Egyptian the bird god.
Osiris is the hawk. And
it has that feeling to, you know, I think because there's all this allusions to the pyramids and
Horus.
Horus, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what that does.
Yeah, no, there's some just there's some Egyptology going through this.
Yeah.
There's also some great, like, San Francisco art mythology going on.
Do tell.
Well, because they have all the really great... goofy San Francisco writers from the turn of the century. They have Jack London. They have Clark Ashton Smith, who wasn't really a San Francisco. He was a California guy. He probably did spend some time in San Francisco, but he mostly was sort of a recluse living up in the country nearby.
It didn't make me want to read Jack London.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, Jack London did write horror, apparently.
Really?
Yeah.
who knows, maybe we'll whip out some Jack London horror stories. I actually would kind of like to read some early, some pre, like late 19th century, early, like weird tales, like Arthur Machen or Algernon Blackwood or M.R. James. M.R. James is referred to in here a lot. He's another ghost story writer who is, I don't know, I think he might be enjoying a kind of a renaissance. Yeah, because Penguin Books just published a couple of collections.
What did he write?
Oh, you know, I couldn't name you any stories off the top of my head, but I do know that a lot of horror writers mention him in the same breath with Lovecraft as an inspiration.
Well, I happen to be looking at Wikipedia as we speak, and he wrote a book called "The Ghost Stories of Antiquary." Mm-hmm. A Thin Ghost and Others, mm-hmm. A Warning to the Curious and Other Ghost Stories.
Yes, he wrote lots and lots of ghost stories.
And it's also, it sounds like it's very Freudian.
Could be, although it may slightly predate Freud. But yet another James.
Freud predated Freud.
Yeah, Freud predated Freud. Yeah.
So what did, he presents a lot. There is a lot going on in this book.
I know, and a lot of it's going on. A lot of what goes on in this book depends on how widely read you are in the fantasy, horror, and science. Well, specifically fantasy and supernatural horror.
Well, but genre. Even without that, there's still a lot going on because there's things coming in from every angle. Because
every
there's angle. This thing about books, mm-hmm. this thing about the city itself,
yeah.
and the metaphor.
What's the name of the book? Megalopolisomancy or something like that.
Yeah, the megalopolisomancy.
The magic of large cities.
Right. So there's that.
Yeah.
And then there's these supernatural creature called the what's the word
already,
for it?
Oh, the paramentals.
Paramentals.
Yes.
So there's the paramentals. So yep. There's that. And then there's, you know, then there's this going back in the past.
Yep.
And these curses that are set up.
The curses.
That are sort of set in motion.
Yeah. There's also the story of a recovering alcoholic.
There's the recovering alcoholic.
There's the grieving widower. The grieving widower.
The return to life sort of
yep.
thing.
Yep.
The power of women.
Oh.
Which again resurfaces.
Oh yeah, no, this is, it's really
the
good.
The loneliness of the academic.
Kind of. There's so much to talk about this book that we're actually not. We're just going to end up. I just know that we're just going to end up skidding around over the top of it.
Maybe, and you know, I have a hard time thinking. Well, did I like? You know, as I distance myself from it, I liked it, and then I hate it at the same time.
Really?
Yeah.
See that I having.
But you know,
just,
I'm always like that with every book that I read.
I just having just finished it. I can tell that this book is one that will get better with repeated readings.
I think that is one of the. I think it's one of those books where you have to read some things about the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when I read the annotations, then it was like, oh, okay, now I get what he's trying to do. Because it's kind of immersed in other histories and other.
Yeah. Now this book won the World Fantasy Award when it came out, and I got to think that the World Fantasy Award I don't know anything really about it.
They must have been in their salad days when they were.
No, I'm guessing that the World Fantasy Award is given out not by by the rank and file readers, but by members of the Writers Guild.
Yeah,
who know where.
Yes,
he's
who was he
from.
Trying to please when he wrote?
I think he was trying to please himself because he went through a real bad patch. When he's talking about the drinking life, I think he's speaking from a real private place.
And he was a well-known drunk.
And as you know, the thing that the detail that gets makes it seem most like a novel written by a recovering alcoholic is the fact that in his apartment he discovers alcohol that he doesn't know is there. but it was still there. Now, only a real alcoholic would write that because that stinks of rationalization. He knew it was there.
He knew it was there. There's a famous F. Scott Fitzgerald story called Babylon Revisited about a recovering alcoholic going back to Paris. And he's, you know, he can't even remember what he did back in those days, back in his salad days, but he's back there now and he's trying to, you know, put his life back together. And he only has one drink a day because, you know, that way it doesn't grow too large in his mind. The fact that this,
that you have to do that means you're an alcoholic.
The fact that you have to do that means that you are an alcoholic and you are not quite there yet. You are still you're hanging on by a thread.
Well, the other thing in this book that comes out is his, an homage to Pygmalion.
How so?
Well, I think this kind of, he has in his bed, this creature.
Oh, yeah.
This woman, the scholar's wife.
The scholar's wife.
Yeah. Basically,
explain that to me. I was trying to get my head around that. So that's like a, what the hell is that? A scholar?
Well, the scholar's, it was just his name for, he had all his books and things he was reading.
Yeah.
In bed next to him.
Yeah.
So in his mind, it sort of took on the form of a woman.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Because they were just all piled up.
Yeah. Which, of course.
And he was lonely, and this was his company. And so he would call it his scholar's wife because he just had everything he was reading or wanting to read in his bed next to him.
Yes.
And
he would literally curl up with it.
Yes, exactly. Curling up with a good book.
Books.
So there's a little masturbation going on in this.
Very possibly.
But that, to me, that reminded me of Pygmalion. Just sort of that here's his creation.
Yeah.
And it comes to life.
And that's
a twisted Pygmalion.
Yeah. That's.
I mean,
that
the becomes, Pygmalion. Not
that becomes the avatar of the Lady of Darkness.
Yeah, the avatar. Or whatever.
Yeah. In the end, when he has to wrestle with her and is saved by
Logic.
Logic and the Lady in White.
Right. But by
logic.
By
musical logic. Music and math.
Yeah, math and logic and science.
And science, yeah. So
I did like that scene. And again it goes back to it harkens back to Conjure Wife, where these two worlds intersect.
Yep. Yep.
Magic. And magic and science, I don't even know if it's purely science, but magic and rationalism, or magic and order.
Yeah.
Magic is almost
is
ordered disorder in a way.
That final scene was, I thought it was really well done. I mean, but the whole book is basically.
It was one of those scenes where you have to go back, like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
I read it like three times.
Yeah, I know. You have to go around and around a couple times, and you have to go back, and you're like, okay, so that's why he was talking about spending all this time talking about the scholar's wife, really, in like, you know, in chapter four or whatever. And you have to, you know, go through another 100 pages before it becomes, you know, he'll
but
touch
there
on
really
it. Once
are, I mean, there really are all these things going on at once, and you're like, he is throwing in the kitchen sink, and his neighbor's kitchen sink.
Yeah,
in this
which is kind of a tendency of the last, you know, the last novels. You know, this is it. This is my big swan song. The person who took it, you know, way too far was that Irish guy James Joyce, who just threw everybody's kitchen sink
and the babies and the bathwater
and the street sweepings. Yeah, you know, everything. But this one, it's sort of the same thing. This is everything I know, everything I've learned.
And it kind of doesn't all go together, but it kind of does.
It kind of does. Well, you know, I mean, that's what you're left with at the end, I think.
You're
like, well, I did all this stuff.
Because there's immigrants, and there's deafness, and there's music, and there's gay boys.
Yeah,
and
the gay boys. Yeah, and there's the homophiliacs.
There's the homophiliacs, and there's the houses.
Don't hit me, I'm a homophiliac. It was, you know, Fritz Leiber, at this time, he was probably, I don't know, he must have been at least in his 60s when he wrote this.
And he was living in San Francisco, he was in the heyday of the...
Heyday, just before everything came, the gay crazy.
Yeah, because 79, right before AIDS struck.
Right before AIDS struck.
So that city must have been, and you know,
when
you read this, you know, he's trying to make it kind of dark and spooky and everything like that. But you can tell he actually kind of loves it. I think he really loves the city.
Well, yeah, he does love the city. Yeah. It is definitely a in praise of San Francisco. Yeah. And it's interesting because I think, you know, he loves the city, but he also is, it seemingly, I mean, he makes the city an enemy in a way, that by virtue of the city being what it is, that it attracts certain things, that there's a darkness to it because of how it is.
Yeah,
it is constructed and what cities stand for.
And, yeah, and he talks about that, you know, darkness, you know, just regular urban darkness.
Right.
He talks about, you know, murders and drug deals gone bad and muggers. And
that cities sort of create that.
Yeah.
That horror, its own horror.
Yeah. But, this is kind of by the way, in the book, the real horror in the book is this ancient curse.
Well, but it's only there because of the city.
Yes.
Because of this, what the city is constructed. It's the idea of ley lines. I think too. I mean, that there's this power. You know, do you know ley lines?
No, I don't.
The idea of ley lines is that, you know, there's like a grid on the earth, on the world, on the land itself. And there's lines that run through in every which way. And these lines are lines of power. And so that's, you know, the idea would be like, that's why Stonehenge was built where it was. It sort of magnifies and captures that power.
Okay.
And that's the thing with this city, is that it almost creates its own ley lines of power that draw these things, like, well, make these creations.
That makes sense, because there's a big business about earthquakes in here, obviously. And so there's a ley line, an actual geophysical ley line, the San Andreas Fault running nearby. And earthquakes are a big deal. They talk about, you know, it's not really made clear, but the 1906 earthquake may or may not have been
caused by the sorcerer,
DeCastries.
Yeah, DeCastries.
Tybalt DeCastries.
Yeah. Because he wanted to take the city down. He was doing like guerrilla magic warfare against the city.
Yeah, yeah. Magic nihilists, nihilism. Yeah. Yeah. Which is, again, very Lovecraftian. To destroy the earth is to show it the truth.
And I think it's interesting is that then he creates this thing that isn't really meant for the people who get it. But he creates this evil that is sort of set in motion.
Yeah.
And it just, these people just happen to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it just happens to be this.
He enlists
this convergence of things happening.
Yeah. No, he enlists the glitterati of San Francisco, that whole scene with Jack London and.
Right.
And George Sterling. And
right.
They're supposed to like do things, and it's supposed to be, you know, very groovy and, you right. know, very bohemian. And they're too drunk to pull it off. They just can't get it right.
Which is really kind of, you know, if you think about
that's
it.
How
really,
it goes.
In the 60s, it really is like what was happening there.
Yeah.
Probably what he experienced.
Yeah. People were just.
They were too high. People were too fucked
up. Too fucked up to pull off the revolution.
And they wanted to exactly. And they sort of chicken out a little bit. And
yeah. Well, you know, just the one theory that the 68 revolution in France kind of fell apart simply because it was the end of the school term and everybody sort of, all the students went home. And it just sucked the wind right out of it, and pretty soon it's all done.
Yeah.
And it pretty much was exactly why it just fell apart. Anyway.
It really was a good sort of observation of, you know, what happens with fads.
Yeah.
And so these.
Well, you're right. I was going to say that the perspective of this book is of an older man who's really seen a lot. I don't think anybody can say that Fritz Leiber hadn't seen a lot at this point in his life. In San Francisco, as an older man, looking at all this craziness and kind of loving it a little bit, but it's kind of just saying, "Yeah, you know, this is all you know, stuff and nonsense. It's just a moment in history. The big picture, the big curve of history, is much more profound and devastating, more earthquake-like than this. I don't know. I found that interesting because you read about.
Well, the character isn't that old though.
Well, I think the way, late 40s. Well, the way I read him is that he's older than that.
Really?
Yeah, I do. And his girlfriend, this angel of light.
I put her in her late 20s.
No, I think she's older than that. She has a successful and lengthy classical music career. Well, I don't know. What else do you want to talk about in this book? It's kind of hard because there's literally so much to talk about. Mm-hmm. But I honestly think I would have to read it again to get a handle on it. No, seriously.
Who was your favorite character?
Oh, the main character.
What did you like about the main character?
I liked his confusion. I liked his I liked the fact that I was convinced that Fritz Leiber was really trying to express something real about himself in this book. This is a confessional. This is what he knows about life, about his life, and I like that. I thought that was very honest. It's not easy to write an autobiography in fantasy or science fiction. That reminds me. This book reminded me more than anything else as I was reading it of a Philip Dick novel, A Scanner Darkly, which was more or less Philip Dick's attempt to write about his life, things he knows about drug culture and people who just can't get their self together and himself and get it published because he could never get his nonfiction works published. His publishers only wanted science fiction, so he drifted thinly in a thin layer of science fiction and got it published. And it's it's a movie now, and it's actually fairly faithful to the book. And this book here, I think you can learn a lot about Fritz Leiber or how Fritz Leiber thinks of himself. But he's a fantasy science fiction writer, so he's got to write in those genres. And that's how he got it published. I mean, he did write little autobiographical pieces, apparently. I haven't read them. But he can't buy those in mass market paperbacks like these.
Well, it's funny because the book is very mannered, I think. I mean,
It's written in a weird tale
style. It's written in a... Yeah, and his descriptions of things are... It's kind of over the top.
Yeah, he talks
this is going to be a, he takes San Francisco.
Yeah, well, he talks about the purple pen of the journal writer, who may or may not have been Clark Ashton Smith. He's talking specifically about purple ink. Clark Ashton Smith was writing in a very extremely mad style.
I thought he was
talking
about Prince. Purple ink, purple ink.
Also a very mannered style.
Very mannered.
And what you're reading in this book then is honestly a very hard-nosed, watered-down, comparatively version of that prose style, that weird tales style, Lovecraft style, Clark Ashton Smith style, some of the other writers' style.
And freakily devoid of sex. There is a sexiness to it.
They always go to commercial.
Yeah,
Well, you were saying at another recording that we were doing that Fritz Leiber may have done writing for TV.
Yeah, I thought
did
he
you
did.
Find that out? Maybe he
I
did.
I thought he did.
Yeah, because he's in this book.
I'll tell you what. Why don't we pause and open up this bottle of Werewolf and take a gander. And we'll come back.
All right. She told me more about me than I knew myself. She dealt two cards, queen and a three, and mumbled some words that were so strange to me. And then she turned up a two-eyed jack. My eyes saw red, but the cards still stayed black. And I believe we're starting again. I'm just going to continue opening up Werewolf here. Why don't you, you said you were going to read...
I wanted to read the... so, in the end of the... In the
listen to the children of the night.
In the end of the book, the lady, the scholar's mistress is... Inveigled. And I like Inveigled.
Well, it starts it's in, swirling around him.
It's Inveigled, and it becomes...
engulfs him, and is starting to drag him.
Well, it gets... The way I was seeing is that all the pages ripped up and sort of took on this form. It used the books as a form.
Yes.
Well, and it was interesting, because he sort of calls it into being, because he's sort of half in a weird... state, and he's looking at this figure on his bed, and he's like, oh, the shoulders are Lovecraftian shoulders.
Yeah, and with the ink and the stuff. Yeah,
yeah, and he's sort of longingly looking at this.
All of his, it's an extremely loaded image, symbol. That.
So we're drinking a little bit of the werewolf right now, a Merlot from 2003
werewolf.
And you know what? It's not half bad.
Ooh, a little sour, but not too bad.
It's not too bad.
Yeah. I would say it's right up there with Vampire.
It's, how do I want to say it? It's mothy.
Here, smell the cork.
It's mothy. It's mildewy.
It tastes like,
It smells like...
It tastes like Scottish Moors.
Yeah, you know what? It smells like peat.
It smells like... It's very peaty.
It smells like peat piter. It smells like the guy... No, it smells like peat moss.
Like peat moss, like a bog
moss. Or Randy Moss. Yeah, Randy Moss.
Randy Moss. Yeah, Randy Moss. So, you were going to read that scene.
So anyhow, this creature rises up.
Yep.
And is attacking him. Where, it's not really clear what's... What it's going to do to the protagonist.
It's swirling around him. It's in an attacking / loving embrace. It wants to pull him in some way. And
In walks Calpurnia. And where she comes up with this, we'll never know.
Oh, it's been set up earlier in the book. It is. But.
So this she invokes in the names of Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven, the names of Pythagoras, Newton, and Einstein, by Bertrand Russell, William James, and Eustace Haydon, begone, all inharmonious and disorderly shapes and forces, depart at once! And that does it. Which I loved.
I don't know.
I loved that she came in and she started invoking all these Pythagoras
and Newton and Einstein. It's, I found it a little heavy-handed.
It was very heavy-handed, but it was funny. I thought it was tongue-in-cheek at that point.
Maybe it was a little tongue-in-cheek. Fritz Leiber does have a lot of fun. He does, I mean...
It's sort of that tongue-in-cheek.
He's making little jokes through this whole book.
It's kind of tongue-in-cheek the way your, like, proper aunt would be tongue-in-cheek. You know?
Yeah.
Your proper British auntie would... Yeah,
proper British auntie
would say something that's a little blue.
He makes a lot of goofy little allusions in here, simply for people who are clued in. Like, he talks about, he speculates about what happened to Ambrose Bierce when he went to Mexico and disappeared. And at some point, just throws in the line, Old Gringo, which is, you know, the writer Carlos Fuentes?
I don't.
Carlos Fuentes, a Spanish language writer, has a novel, really famous novel called Old Gringo, which is about Ambrose Bierce in Mexico and what happens to him. It's all speculation. Maybe we should read some Ambrose Bierce.
I don't know, but I'm going to throw this wine down the drain. It's bad.
We have revised our
because the more it breathes, the more dead it becomes. It is.
Yeah, it's kind of wretched.
It is. Oh, God, it's just putrid. That was a waste of $6.
$6 whole.
$6.
Oh, wow. Well, it's this is a lesson learned. I will still sip
at it. It was a wonderful bottle, though.
I will sip at it, but not as enthusiastically as I might. I don't know. What else do you want to talk about this book?
What do you wish? I like my favorite question. What do you wish would have been in this book or would have happened in this book that didn't?
I wish in this book that they had, you know, as much as they spend sort of tooling around San Francisco, they name places. They go to the library, they go to the concert hall, they go to Corona Heights. But they don't like,
where they make the beer.
Where they make the beer. Well, they don't like go to Chinatown. They don't they talk about being on the hate, but they don't really go
there. They're not
there.
Wearing crotchless chaps in,
yeah.
in the Castro.
Yeah. they talk about you know being in the Mission, and they talk about the used bookstores. I was in San Fran not too long ago. And,
which they would never say San Fran.
No.
In San Fran.
Yeah,
or Frisco.
Yeah, but here in the indescript in
Smallville, USA.
In Smallville, in a Doppeltown.
Doppeltown, I like that.
In Doppeltown.
I like that.
we can call it San Fran.
We call it Frisco.
Frisco. Like yeah, it'll get somebody hot rice roni dumped out of your pants.
Hey, before we end this little charade we call a book group,
it is rapidly devolving, so we might as well just circle the drain until it goes.
We have to talk about the tower because
the
this tower comes up over and over and over. It's overbearing, and
that was the reason I think the tower was there.
The tower hides the ashes of the
dead
sorcerer. Mm-hmm. It is this thing that hangs in the distance that he likes the protagonist enamored of it in a way. And the lights.
I thought that it first appeared in the novel specifically because Liber was trying to sort of write his version of the Haunter of the Dark. And in the Haunter of the Dark, there's a steeple. That steeple in the distance is absolutely central to that story.
And I suppose it is the modern steeple, the TV tower, the modern church steeple. It's what we worship every day, pretty much.
I think he just worked from there.
I wish he would have spent more time with the characters as people. But then they were mostly vehicles of ideas.
They're kind of pretty thin sketches.
Yeah.
That element of the book was the thing that I think most reminded me of the Philip K. Dick of A Scanner Darkly.
Hmm.
Because those characters aren't very well fleshed out. I think the reason for that is because he's trying to write about specific people he knows. But at the same time, backing off a little bit so that, you know, he doesn't
get offend sued.
Or offend them or freak them out, yeah.
I also would like to have seen the secondary story told more as a flash, maybe not as a flashback, but as a kind of a parallel story.
Oh, the story.
On its own.
The story of
taking
the Castries.
Yeah, taking it more of a first from a first person or a third person. You know,
I didn't really balk at that because that's such a common way of telling stories in a Lovecraftian story. You get part of the story through interview or from reading old newspaper accounts or from reading a journal or a diary,
which is very like Bram Stoker in a way if you think about it.
It is actually very much so. Yeah,
he was one of the first people to write a story that way.
Bram Stoker? Yeah, well, writing an epistolary novel, but using
newspaper clippings. I mean, every little thing.
Cylinder phonographs.
Right.
Things like that, yeah. So, yeah, no, this invention of Stoker's may be the reason that horror writers have used that convention.
Yeah, if I was going to write a book, that's how I would do it.
Yeah. And people theorize, you know.
And if you think about it, games like Myst is really done like that. There's these little these little things.
Yeah, that... I mean, it gives the fantastic some it makes it seem more real because you're dealing with documents with like primary evidence. It's not like tales told. It's like, you know, I'm experiencing this now. So I'm writing this down in a journal, in a letter. It's a newspaper clipping. These are actual events
that are verifiable. Where can we get this book that he's talking about?
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the ongoing jokes for people who are into Lovecraft is, you know, when you first get into Lovecraft, people read Lovecraft and then they go to the local used bookstore and say, excuse me, do you have a copy of the Necronomicon? And the bookseller will just shake their head and say, no, that it's an invented book.
Has anybody ever written the Necronomicon?
Yeah, at least twice.
Oh, was it bad?
Probably. Yeah. I've never read it.
Was it like gnomes?
Gnomes too. No, there's
Necronomicons.
There was one version that was written, I don't know, in the late 60s, early 70s or something like that. And there's a new one that was just published in Doppeltown by a local occult
in the state of Brooding Lake
Brooding Lake local occult publisher and New Age publisher published the Necronomicon. And actually there's a book now that's sort of a sequel which is apparently the biography of the author of the Necronomicon, the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred.
Oh yes.
The Mad Arab.
The Mad Arab. Doesn't he run the falafel shop down on...
he does! He's always calling down the dark king. Gods. He's like, oh, Cthulhu! Please make this tahini sauce work! In the name of Nyarlathotep!
A curse on your hummus! And oh, your little garbanzos.
Don't piss off the Mad Arab. Otherwise you'll have the worst falafel sandwich ever.
You have the driest falafel.
The driest falafel.
And all your wine will taste like werewolf wine, which really tastes like wolf urine. That's what I've decided.
This is pretty harsh wine.
You have to be a hard broiled Romanian to drink this.
Yeah, wine. You have to be focused on the goal, which is unconsciousness, to drink this whole bottle.
I can't even describe.
Eyes on the prize. Eyes on the prize.
I can't
Eyes on
the even prize. Describe the taste.
Well,
of this.
See the
it's
the like, nose is actually deceivingly
pleasant.
It's not bad,
but the taste is
and,
is your pure urethra,
pure urethra.
Now, after drinking almost this whole glass, now I'm deadened to it, and it tastes okay.
So. The foretaste, it's got some interesting things going on, but it's so dry.
It's very tannin.
Yeah, that it's just like sucking on a lemon.
It's like licking a werewolf's ass. we are rimming the werewolf.
Oh dear, I think we might have to do some editing on this one.
No,
never.
We are an adult books group. A charade of an adult.
Where did I see that we were labeled as explicit?
I have made us explicit.
Well, good. Thank you.
Fuck shit, damn.
You donkey raping asshole.
So obviously we have nothing more to say about this book,
except I hope that you know. I feel as though people who are coming to this podcast, some of them may have actually read the book, and.
I would like to hear what people have to say about
it. That you will have something interesting to say about it. This book's been around for
since 78,
damn near 30 years. So has been written about quite extensively. I was Googling around and found PDF documents of scholarly abstracts about people writing about this book. People have earned their PhDs in part writing on this book. So I'm sure there's lots to say about it, and I'd love to hear it.
So we're going to put a stake in this puppy.
Put a stake in this puppy, put garlic in its mouth.
And cut off its head. And then our next book's going to be...
Necroscope.
Necroscope.
By Brian Lumley, a towering classic that some people have mixed reactions to. I've never read this book. Mike here has read this book.
This is my second read, so...
Maybe so you'll be
very interested in what I have to say. It'll be so wise.
So very wise.
And we'll continue our discussion of things Lovecraftian. And if anybody has any suggestions of books to read, please email us at necropod@gmail.com. Necronomapod.
The book group, podcast.
Email is necronomapod@gmail.com. That's our email.
That's our email. So send it on, and we'll read it and politely respond or ignore you.
Cheerio.
Cheerio.
Ah! Who is very close to you. My advice is that you leave this place. Never come back and forth.